So tonight we're beginning our study of the Scripture of Great Wisdom. One of the best-known sutras in the Buddhist tradition, probably the best-known sutra in the Buddhist tradition. We're basing our study on Shohaka Akamura's book, Living by Vow, but I may not actually refer directly to the book too much. But I really do want to leave discussion time each time that we meet about this scripture. And I hope that you all will bring either questions or comments or things that struck you in the book that were particularly important or helpful to you and contribute that to our discussion, because I think that's how we really help each other and widen our own views. So I'm hoping you'll all feel free to do that. Also, in this kind of format, I'm happy to be interrupted if I'm on a track that's just not, that you don't understand for some reason, or if I've glossed over something that you don't know anything about, or that sort of thing, stop me and we can talk about it in place rather than having to remember and come back to it later. Okay? So tonight we're going to begin with the beginning. And we'll talk about the title of the sutra first of all, and then also about the lines, when one with deepest wisdom of the heart. And this is our Order of Buddhist Contemplatives translation made by Reverend Master Jiyu. When one with deepest wisdom of the heart that is beyond discriminative thought, the Holy Lord, Great Kanzeyan Bosatsu, knew that the skandhas five were, as they are, in their self nature, void, unstained, and pure. And if we have time, we'll go on to the next few lines and see how far we get. I think I want to begin with a kind of banner headline and say, this sutra is about the practice of meditation, and not just formal sitting meditation, but meditation in daily life. And I think if we start with that as kind of our overarching sense of direction, I'm hoping by the time we get into this, we'll see how that's so, if we're not already convinced of that. Okay? And I think that that's what's important to me about our studying the scripture, is that it come alive in our lives, that it not just be kind of some intellectual or academic knowledge or understanding that we have, or logical argument that we can make, but that we actually bring it into our lives and are practicing it in our lives, and that it's relevant to our lives. It's relevant to what we're doing every day. It's not just this thing we recite when we come to group or whatever it is. So that's the beginning point. The sutra is about the practice of meditation on the cushion and in our daily lives. The sutra itself comes out of a tradition of sutras called the Prajnaparamita tradition, which came into being about the time of Christ, maybe a century earlier, give or take a century. And the origins of Buddhism are kind of hidden in a fog. And sometimes I think speculating about them too much isn't productive, because we're never going to really know the roots of history and what all this meant to people when that way back then, as opposed to us now in modern Western culture. But the Prajnaparamita literature is really the seminal literature of the Mahayana tradition. So Mahayana is preceded by the Theravadan tradition, the tradition of the elders that came directly out of the Buddha. And then things began to morph. And Mahayana is what Zen is a part of. And I think you all have studied this, haven't you, because you've done history of Buddhism type talks. And the Prajnaparamita sutras are sutras that are basically about emptiness, this word shunyata, emptiness, which we'll talk about more as we go on. And there's a series of them, and one of them is in 800,000 lines. There's one in 25,000 lines. There's one in 8,000 lines. The Scripture of Great Wisdom, which is most commonly known as the Heart Sutra, as most of you know, is almost the shortest version of it. And the very shortest version is the syllable ah, because the syllable ah, syllables were thought in Sanskrit to have religious significance and meaning, and that reciting them changed us spiritually. And the syllable ah, ah is believed to contain all the meaning of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, including the longest ones. 250,000 lines, I'm sorry, I said 800,000, but it's 250,000. 250,000, 8,000, and there are a number of other lengths of versions. So the reason the Heart Sutra is called the Heart Sutra is because it's the heart of the Prajnaparamita teachings. It has some reference to the physical heart, too. The word is the same. And I think there's some significance in that reference to the physical heart, which in Eastern culture is often more important than the brain in terms of who we really are and what we're really up to as human beings. So the Heart Sutra is both a reference to the physical heart, to the fact that these sutras are the core. The Heart Sutra itself is the core of the Prajnaparamita teachings. Okay, so it says it all in a nutshell. The official name of the sutra, as you can tell from your... Does everybody have one of these who wants one? Because you're not required. John, would you like one?
Yes, take one.
More. So what I'm passing out to John is our chat and Roger.
We forgot ours.
Okay. If you don't, if you have one at home and can leave that one behind. Is that everybody? Do you want another one of your own, Jim?
Sure.
Yeah, you might as well. Yeah. But if you could leave them behind if you have them at home, because there may be others who want them. Not to be stingy, we could always make more copies. But if you look at the title of the script of the sutra, or the scripture, Reverend Master Jiu has called it the Scripture of Great Wisdom. Other people call it the Heart of Prajnaparamita Sutra, or the Heart Sutra. And in the second column, you see the official Sanskrit name of the sutra, Mahaprajnaparamita-Hridaya Sutra. And I want to just say a few words about the title of the sutra because I think it matters. So Maha means great or vast or absolute. So it's talking about something very big, but also very ultimate, okay, or very fundamental. Prajna is usually translated as wisdom, and it actually refers in the Buddhist context to a specific kind of wisdom, which is the wisdom of emptiness. Again, we're back to that word emptiness, which is a translation of the Sanskrit word shunyata. Again, we'll talk about that more as we go along. But this is a reference to a specific kind of wisdom. Now, that kind of wisdom is what leads to enlightenment, or what is necessary for enlightenment, according to the Buddhist teaching. The figure on the altar is a representation of Prajnaparamita. So Prajnaparamita gets personified in this figure, which is a very clearly female figure, if you don't mind my mentioning that, and who's sitting in meditation, actually in very deep meditation. Her particular mudra is the turning of the wheel of the law. It's teaching mudra. Sometimes you see her with a scripture in one hand and a lotus in the other hand. And the scripture is the scripture, the Prajnaparamita scriptures. So she embodies this wisdom of emptiness. And because that wisdom of emptiness is necessary in order to become enlightened, she's called the mother of the Buddhas. And the literature writes about her as a being, if we can use that word, or from whom the Buddhas emanate, and who they revere as their mother. So there's something very touching and warm and human about that, isn't there? I really appreciate that. So I thought it would be kind of nice while we were talking about the scripture that her representation be on the altar. And there are places in the East where they hold festivals in her honor.
May I ask?
Yeah.
Are we talking about a historical
being?
Being?
No, we're not. It's similar to the way a bodhisattva embodies a principle like compassion, or Manjushri's wisdom, the sword, you know, a Buddhist wisdom that cuts through delusion. We're talking about, you know, there are people who experience the bodhisattvas as beings. And sense them in their lives as beings. And I don't think that that's not true. I think that people genuinely experience that. It's not my way of relating to it. I think of it more as a bodhisattva is someone, something that embodies a quality that we're cultivating in ourselves as part of our spiritual practice. So I tend to be on that end of the spectrum. But you'll find people in all places along that line. And in fact, Reverend Master Daisui, when he was head of the order, had a kind of a retreat for masters of the order. This was 18 years ago or so. And they talked about this, that, you know, for some, they talked about these principles that lay along a spectrum, and how different masters come out in different places on these spectrums. And one of them is personification versus more of a, what would the word be?
Icon or imagery.
Yeah, icon, imagery, or not even that, almost an idea, you know? So I just say that by way of saying that, you know, there's a very clear confirmation of this variety of the ways these things express themselves in our spiritual lives, and that variety is valid, that there isn't one way, one place or another to land, and then you've got it, or you've gone deeper, or that kind of thing. Okay, so Prajnaparamita to me is definitely not a historical being. If she appears to you, great, but to me she's more a kind of embodiment or representation of this wisdom of emptiness. Okay?
But she's also like...
I'm sorry?
She's like Mary. She's the mother.
You could... They're in a way, yeah. Yeah, except... Well, no, I don't think I'm going to go there tonight.
Well, of course, there are accepts, yes.
What?
There are accepts, but with the Christian tradition.
Yeah, right. Okay, so prajna is this wisdom of shunyata. Prajna also means, the etymology of the word means before knowing. And I find that very interesting because it's pointing to a kind of wisdom that we have before we know something. And again, I think that's something we can explore a little bit as we go on, if it comes up for us. Now, paramita means perfection, and it also means crossing to the other shore. And I think that dual meaning is interesting. So we have prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. So this is pointing to the highest wisdom, the most perfect form of wisdom, okay? And you may be familiar with the six paramitas, which are, if I can remember them, let's see, generosity, virtue, or following the precepts, patience, vigor, meditation, and wisdom. So prajna is the sixth of those six paramitas, which are, in Mahayana Buddhism, considered a really important path of training towards Buddhahood. Okay? So prajna paramita is the perfection of wisdom, but it's also crossing the other to the other shore. And what this is pointing to is that practicing wisdom transforms our lives. Okay? So the crossing to the other shore, is, as some of her, all of you know, is a reference to moving from samsara to nirvana. It's the movement from the life of suffering, running around on the wheel of rebirth and suffering over and over again because we keep clinging to things or we keep being deluded about things or we keep being attached to a self. That's samsara. And the other shore is nirvana, where suffering ceases, where we stop, where all of that becomes transformed. And that's one way to think about it. But we also talk about the other shore being here on this shore. And the reason we talk about that is because samsara and nirvana are actually one. And it's really, I often think about it in terms of, do you know that image that looks like a duck or a rabbit, depending on how you look at it? It's the same image, but you look at it differently and it becomes something different. So when we're caught up in grasping, attachment, delusion, self, we see samsara. And when we let go of all of that, when we put it down and enter into compassion and wisdom, the wisdom of prajna, we're in nirvana. But the conditions are exactly the same. Okay.
Is that emptiness also?
I wouldn't say it's exactly the same thing, but I would say it's very related because when you see things through emptiness, nirvana appears. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, so Hridaya means heart. We've already talked about that. Sutra is a sutra or a scripture. The word sutra means thread. It may be related to the English word sutra. That's never made any sense to me in terms of why that word, except that my master said that the sutras, the scriptures all together, are the threads that make up our kesas, whatever form of a kesa you've got, even if it's not a physical kesa. Okay? All of our practicing is a kesa. Okay, so that's the title. Let me just make sure I didn't. I wanted to go back to the prajna, which is the wisdom of emptiness, the foreknowing, I said. No, I think I'm going to save that. Sorry, I'm going to save that for later. Okay. But I think what's important about the crossing to the other shore image is that we're talking about a transformation of our way of life. And this is how the scripture's talking to how we're living, okay, and how we're practicing. Okay, so the scripture opens with, when one with deepest wisdom of the heart. So when one with, one is referring to being one with something. It's not one, a person. Mm-hmm. And people have expressed that. Have misconceived that. So when we're one with the deepest wisdom of her heart, this is actually referring to Kanzeon, who is Avalokiteshvara, okay? So when Kanzeon or Avalokiteshvara is one with the deepest wisdom of the heart, all right? So the deepest wisdom of the heart that she's one with is prajna paramita, which is the wisdom that's beyond discriminative thought, okay? Discriminative thought is our rational thinking mind, our logical mind, our analytical mind, our kind of normal everyday perceptions. And beyond discriminative thought is prajna, wisdom, emptiness, or mystical experience, for that matter. And so she is sitting in a place that has let go of that those thought habits we have that discriminate between things, which has a lot of implications for where we come to eventually, which is non-duality and lack of separation. But we'll get there later, okay? I want to say something about the word Lord, the Holy Lord, great Kansei on Bozatsu. So when one with deepest wisdom of the heart is beyond discriminative thought. Wait, before I say that, I want to point out that in the other translations, they say she's immersed in Prajnaparamita, coursing in Prajnaparamita, or practicing the deep practice of Prajnaparamita. And I think that, or deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, I think that use of the word, well, coursing or immersed in shows some kind of action, right? But practicing the deep practice of Prajnaparamita points to the fact that this is a practice. So Kanzian isn't just sort of sitting around in some great samadhi, oblivious to everything, but she's actually practicing Prajnaparamita. Okay? And that's how it has to live in our lives, is as that practice. Okay? And we'll try to talk more about that as we go on. Akamura points out that Kanzeon here is really Kanzaiji, and he translates that as to see freely or clearly without obstruction, without the distortions of intellect, desire, concepts, conventions, or expectations. To see reality as it is. And what he's trying to say is that this is what prajna is, this seeing of reality as it actually is, free of obstruction, seeing it clearly, free of distortions of the intellect. Okay?
So that's wisdom.
That's wisdom. Right, yeah. So this place beyond discriminative thought, which is outside the discriminatory mind or the mind of thought, judgment, criticism, is sometimes called discerning wisdom or discriminative wisdom, okay, which is important to distinguish from the discriminatory mind or discriminative thought. Okay, so I'm just trying to point out a possible semantic difficulty we could have if we're not careful about those terms. Okay? So, we've got Kanjijai here. Kanzaiji. Kanjizai. Sorry. I can't get there. K-A-N-G-I-Z-A-I is the form of Avalokiteshvara or Kanzian who is here in the scripture and will eventually be talking to Shariputra. Okay, are we tracking? and the point there is that this particular form of Kanzian is the form of Kanzian that embodies wisdom or prajna. Now, the other thing about Kanzian being here is that it brings compassion into the mix. And part of the whole point of the scripture is all about emptiness or shunyata, right? But actually, it's just as much about compassion. And the presence of Avalokiteshvara is indicating that it's all about compassion as well, because you can't have one without the other. And the two work together in our practice as the two pillars of the Mahayana. Okay? So we've got wisdom and compassion united as we move through the scripture. Okay, I just want to say a little bit about the word Lord, the Holy Lord, great Kanzeon Bozatsu. By the way, Bozatsu is the Japanese transliteration of the word Bodhisattva in Sanskrit. Do we all know what a Bodhisattva is? Okay, great. The word Lord bothers Akamura and it bothers me, and it probably bothers me because of the gender reference. It bothers Akamura because the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas aren't lords. You know, they don't own land, they hardly have anything, and they're not wielding power over people. So I prefer the Holy One in that spot, but If you're tripping, you know, if you're tripping up on the word Lord, there might be good reason why you're tripping up on it. Yeah, Bill.
The word holy.
Mm. Oh. Go ahead.
Well, it sort of implies divinity, and yet that doesn't fit with what I understand about Buddhism.
True, yeah. And I think that word holy maybe points towards a kind of dedication to, or devotion to practice and training. And in this context, indicates someone who is taking that on as a very strong commitment and has made some progress in terms of purifying the mind, releasing defiling passions, and being able to reside in stillness and non-clinging.
So it doesn't have a divinity overtone.
Well, it does to us because of our Christian or Abrahamic religious backgrounds.
Right.
But
Abrahamic,
I don't.
Abrahamic. Okay.
I don't think that's what's intended here when the sutra was written. Does it sound?
Yes, that helps. Thank you.
And we're not going to get very far tonight, I see, because it's past time when I wanted to stop. So let me just say that, so Avalokiteshvara is in this deep, practicing deeply Prajnaparamita, and perceives that the five skandhas are empty, okay, are void, unstained, and pure in their self-nature. So self-nature refers to how they actually are. The five skandhas, do we all know what they are?
Mm-hmm.
We do. Okay, I don't have to talk about the five skandhas. And in a way, you don't even need to know what the five skandhas are, because what's being pointed to with the use of that word is everything that comprises us in early Buddhism, they broke that down into the five skandhas as that's what makes up a being. But it could be anything. You could divide it up in different ways. They're just trying to point to all the things that make up a human being are actually empty, void, unstained, and pure. And it's not just that I'm empty, but that each of those skandhas is empty, okay? And self-nature refers to, did I say this already, refers to how they truly are. And then we get to void, unstained, and pure. And I want to stop at this point because what's crucial about this scripture is our understanding of emptiness. And that could be a whole nother talk, and probably will be, knowing me, because I talk too much. So I'll just point out that that Reverend Master Jiu translated it as void, unstained, and pure. Most people translate it as empty. And you'll see that in all these other translations. One says empty nature, but all the rest use the word empty, okay? Now, there's this wonderful, interesting translation by Ta-Nehisi, Kaz Ta-Nehisi, and he says without boundary or boundless or boundlessness, which I think is really interesting. Thich Nhat Hanh says empty as well. So I want to leave it there so we can talk a little bit if we want to, and so we can sit again before we leave and do Vespers. So we're right at the key moment here. So stay tuned for next time when we come together and we'll talk together about the whole understanding, how we understand emptiness and what it is. Somebody said to me recently that they'd never understand this scripture. And that's true. None of us ever will. None of us can ever come to the bottom of the full depth of any of our spirituality. But I do think we can understand the scripture. Maybe not completely, but we can understand it. So I don't think the scripture has to remain elusive and what's the word? Opaque or what?
Like a mystery.
A mystery, yeah, or opaque or outside our comprehension. I think we actually can. come to know what it's all about. And so we'll keep going next time we meet to talk about this and see where we land.